from the Baltimore area of Narcotics Anonymous. I'm a proud member. We're one of the largest areas in the world, and my home group is Therapeutic Value Sunday night. Anybody wants to come on down and visit? Anyway, they asked me to speak about this topic, Principles Before Personalities, and it's a topic near and dear to my heart because I believe spiritual principles are the foundation of our program. I believe when they say that the same addict will use, that it's about change around here, and I believe that the change that they're talking about is the spiritual principles, and I believe the way to that change, the way up and out, is through working the 12 steps. And I believe, my husband says this a lot, that this is a 12-step program, and if you're not working steps, you're not in this program. And I think that, I was a part of this in the beginning, too, because I didn't know, you know, read your steps, write your steps, read them to your sponsor, stick them in the drawer, because I didn't know. My clean date is August 8th, 1990, and I say that because when I got here, I didn't know a whole lot about spiritual principles, and I'll talk to you a little bit about the spiritual part of that. Where I came from a neighborhood in Baltimore called Waverly. I lived there most of my life, a block off of Greenmount Avenue. And what happened in that neighborhood was I didn't know a lot of people who'd been to treatment. I'd never been to treatment, never been to detox. And a lot of the people, big drug of choice in that neighborhood was heroin. And I only had two drugs of choice, alcohol and heroin. I shot dope and I drank. And I didn't do cocaine. I didn't smoke marijuana. I did not do pills. And to me, that made me not an addict. Because I thought addicts did everything. It didn't dawn on me I shot dope. I was an addict. Plus, I had a job. I didn't think addicts had jobs. So I couldn't possibly be an addict. And I owned a house. And addicts didn't own houses. You know, that's what I thought. And so I had no education on the disease of addiction. But what I lived in, I had a lot of mistrust and a lot of fear. And I didn't label that as mistrust and fear. That was a way of life because that's the way I lived and that's the way everybody I knew lived. And that's just the way it was. That is what I thought. That's just the way it was. And so what happened was a day came this August 8th, 1990. Actually, it was a little bit before August 8th, 1990 because I had gotten arrested and I ended up in Narcotics Anonymous on a court slip. And back then, and still probably today, people on court slips were judged, which is not a spiritual principle. And I'll get to that a little later. That's been one of my pet peeves lately. And anyway, so there was a lot of judging going on about this court slip business, and I wouldn't go to the meetings. And like I said, I didn't know anything about Narcotics Anonymous, did not know anything about treatment, addiction, didn't know anything about that, and I was threatened to be violated if I didn't start going to the meetings, and I started to go. And what happened was, after some days, a gentleman approached me and said, asked me if I was a fraud, and I just said, what? What are you talking about? And he says, well, I see you come to these meetings every day, but I don't see you do much else. I don't see you getting phone numbers. I don't see you talking to anybody. I don't see you picking up key tags. So I was just wondering if you were a fraud. And I was highly insulted. And so the next night was a Wednesday night, and there was kind of a big meeting. And some girl was in there sharing about how she didn't want to pick up key tags because it made her part of the club, and she didn't want to be part of the club. And I thought, well, I guess I could pick up a key tag. And they were also talking about the step writing stuff. And that sounded like homework to me. And I thought, I'm way too busy for that. I got kids. I got life. You know, I got all the stuff to do. I don't know what I thought I was doing, but I thought I had stuff to do. And I'm not talking in the mic. Is this mic working? Am I just hollering? I don't know. So anyway, so after this meeting, they did one day, and I ran up there, and I got this one-day key tag, and I looked around for this guy so I could show him I was not a fraud. Yeah. And he wasn't there. And I was mad because I wanted him to see my key tag. So not knowing anything about anything, which was a good thing for me, because if I thought I knew something, I probably wouldn't have been here long. I went up to somebody and said, so when's my clean date? Because I hadn't used since the day I had come to the meetings. But I was confused, and the guy looked at me and he said, today's your clean date because today's the day you started to recover. So that was August 8th, 1990. And I was here to tell you, I've been here ever since. I have not used since that day. And so if you're here, and I'm not saying if relapse is a part of your story, that that wasn't part of God's plan for you, because maybe it was, but you don't have to use again. It doesn't have to be part of your story because it wasn't part of mine. So what happened was I got a sponsor after 30 days, and I started to work some steps. And I was part of that, did the steps and put them in a drawer club. But that was okay because, like I said, I'm a firm, this is my thing about God's plan. And that you can have a different idea. This is just over time what I formulated as God's plan. God has a plan for all of us. God knows where you're going to start. God knows where you're going to end up. How you get there, this is the God's will part, is up to you. And you can make that journey as miserable or as joyous as you want to. And today I am choosing to make that joyous. And I'm doing that through the spiritual principles of Narcotics Anonymous. And that is by living with love, peace, patience, tolerance. That's the joy of this program. And like I said, and I started to get that from working the steps. And what I found was when I would work these steps, I would find the spiritual principles in these steps. And the spiritual principles you find might be different from the spiritual principles I find. And how I found that out was by working with sponsees. You know, when my sponsee gets done a step, I say to them, what spiritual principle did you find in this step, and how are you applying that to your life outside of here? Because I'm telling you, any of us can sit in a meeting for an hour and hug the person sitting next to us and talk real nice. But what are you doing when you leave that meeting? I want to know. What are you doing with your family? What are you doing with your workers, your co-workers? What are you doing to those people down the street from you? That's where the change is, because I can bet you didn't have spiritual principles when you were out there shooting dope, smoking crack. I bet you didn't. You know, and that's where the change is. What spiritual principles are you applying to your life? And you are going to find them in the steps. And when my sponsees share back with me their, what they found, it might not be necessarily what I found. You know, and that's how they help me. And we have this sharing back and forth. So what's happened over time was I was working these steps and I was finding these spiritual principles in my life and I was trying to apply them places. And I will tell you, sometimes I fell very short. So things were starting to happen in my life. And after a couple years clean, when I was trying to apply some of these steps, and like I said, I was falling sometimes short. And I decided, a girl that I went to high school with died of cancer, and I decided I was going to go to this funeral. So I go to the funeral home, and there's a whole bunch of people there that I haven't seen since I've been in high school. Now, mind you, I didn't get clean until I was 35. And the other part of my story is I had three children in active addiction. I was married four times by the time I was 29 years old. I had three children by three different men. Two of them had gone to live elsewhere, and I had a third that I was raising whose father died of a drug overdose when he was four. So I had a lot of family baggage, okay? So I had this one child living with me whose father was dead and these two other children, one whose father kidnapped him and disappeared, so I hardly saw this middle child, another one who went to live with his aunt who I was struggling to have a relationship with. I was pretty much succeeding, but I had to initiate that relationship. They weren't cooperating, but I would not give up. So this is what I had going on, and I decided, so I go to this funeral home, and all these people are talking about, gee, she didn't know she was going to die so young. Gee, I don't want to die. Woulda, coulda, shoulda. And I went home, and I thought about that, and I'm like, I don't want to die. Woulda, coulda, shoulda. And I decided to go back to school. So I thought, how can I do this? I got these two, but because by this time now one of my kids, I found the one kid and brought him back. And so now I had these two wild children at home because they were very wild. And how am I going to do this? And nobody in my family ever had a college degree before. I was raised by my mother and my grandmother. I was the oldest of all girls. No men in my family, except for these wild boys I had that I didn't know how to raise boys. It was just everything was crazy, all this insanity. And I was trying to find some spiritual principles in all this. So I decided I'm going to go back to school. And after I quit my job, and I don't have any health insurance, and a couple months go by, my 16-year-old son gets arrested, assault with intent to murder, charges an adult, held on a $75,000 bail. And I felt like my whole life was crashing down around me. And a couple other things happened with my other son, and I thought, how am I going to do this, and how am I going to finish school, and I don't know what to do, and the thought of suicide came real close to me. So what happened was, I was sitting on my kitchen floor with the phone in my lap, and you know this is a fellowship of phone machines and voicemail. So I'm sitting on the floor with this phone in my lap, and I pulled out my phone book because that's what you all taught me to do. And for a couple hours, I sat on that floor and made phone calls because I didn't want to die, and I wanted some help. And I will tell you, not one person I called that night had their... I got every person I called, and that is a miracle. And I was overwhelmed with guilt and fear. I had not a lot of faith that night, and a lot of parent guilt. And anybody with kids knows when they come into this fellowship, you got a lot of parent guilt going on. And this one girl said to me on the phone that self-forgiveness begins with self-acceptance. And I thought about that, and she was right. And I started to forgive myself. And the other thing was, I kept waiting to get my serenity back. Where was my serenity? Where had it gone? You know? And I finally came to believe that my serenity, life on life's terms, was going to keep on coming. My serenity was here in my heart between me and my God. You know, life on life's terms ain't ever going to stop, folks. If you're waiting for that to stop to get your peace, you'll be waiting a very long time. But you get right with your God here in your heart, and you will have your peace. You know, that's what you got to do. Get these spiritual principles here in your heart. That's what's going to fill this hole. That's what's going to make your serenity. You know, that's the spiritual principles. So I got that going, and you know what? Everything turned out okay. You know, it was all right. It took some time. It was in God's time, not mine. I will tell you, if you look back on your life, 99% of your conflict will come from you acting on a different kind of time than God is. You know, you slow down, you go with God's time, things will go a little bit easier. And I will tell you something else. Everything in my life, even I think back to my active addiction that I perceived as a negative, when I waited long enough, turned into a positive. Every single thing. Out of all that stuff that happened with my son, by the time he was 18, he was clean. I put him in a treatment center when he was 18 just to get him off the street for 30 days because a drug dealer was looking to kill him. And that's all I wanted. God, just get him off the street. But God had a bigger plan, and he stayed clean for 6 years. Now, I will tell you, he does not go to meetings anymore, but he owns his own house. And he is married, and he's got 4 beautiful children. You know? And I could have never dreamed that. My humanness My humanness has me boxed in. God's got much more wonderful plans. And you remember that college degree? I was going back to get an AA degree. And in four years, God blessed me with a master's degree. And now I work helping addicts. So I've been sick. I haven't been able to work since January. With the last assignment I had, I was working in West Baltimore with women. And some of those women didn't even have places to live, and they were staying clean, you know. And I see people out there saying, oh, I had a bad day, I'm going to go use. I'm like, you know what, those women, this one woman, her grandchildren got killed in the fires. Other women didn't have a regular place to live, and they were glad to be in that program, staying clean. They came in with smiles on their face every day, just grateful to be alive. And talk about some gratitude. You know, I'm just, I felt grateful to be working with them. I felt like the blessed one. So time went by. I got married in this program. And what happened was we were married 6 months and the man chose to use. And for a year, I struggled in that relationship. And you want to talk about some principles before personalities? People have asked me today, what do you do in that situation? It's hard. You can't. What do you tell somebody who asks you that? I'm going to tell somebody when they should leave their husband. That's not my decision to make. I will tell you when you don't feel safe. But I will tell you when it happened for me. My history and my step work has shown me that I will use with a man. I will use his drug of choice. And what happened was my disease was telling me because he wasn't using my drug of choice and because he wasn't using at my house, it was okay for me to stay in that relationship. Now with him, when he used, women came into the picture. And because his drug of choice was crack, he would stay out for days and days at a time and I would be home by myself never knowing when he was coming back. And after a year of going through this, I was sitting in my house one night, and bingo, my disease says to me, you know, if you used with him, he'd stay home. And that was the day I said, this relationship is done. Because thank God I had enough of a foundation under me to know that was it. So I go and talk to my support group, share in meetings, do all the things that we're told to do. And then my sponsor says to me, you have to pray for him. And her, the girl he was with. I'm like, oh no. Oh no, no, no. Why do I have to do that? You need to do that to get right with God. Oh, but I don't want to. Well, sometimes we got to do things we don't want to do to get right with God. And right with yourself. Well, it took me a few days to think that one over. So I remember, and I had to do this for a while. This is how I started my prayer. God, you know I don't want to do this. Well, what was I going to do, lie to God? Like God don't know? God, you know I don't want to do this, but I'm going to pray for him to let you in his heart and pray for her to let you in her heart. Because I figured if that was my prayer, people who had God in their heart wouldn't do the things they did. That was my hope. And you know what? After I did that for a while, I did it because I wanted to. And you know what? A day came that they both got clean. You know? And that's putting principles before personalities because I did not want to do that. I did not want to do that. And you know what? Last fall, I chaired a meeting for him. You know, I don't have any resentment in my heart anymore because I will tell you, and I found this out, you cannot have positive spiritual thoughts in your mind and be going down a positive spiritual journey when you got anger and resentment in your mind. You cannot be doing both at the same time. And when my sponsor gave me that direction, she knew what she was doing because she needed to get me off that negative path and get me back on the right path. And that's exactly what that did. That's exactly what that did. You know, positive out, positive back. Negative out, negative back. I truly believe that. And that's what those spiritual principles got me. When I put principles before personalities, I reaped the rewards. I reaped the rewards. Whatever he was doing, it was really none of my business at that point. I needed to do what I needed to do for me, regardless. I'll get back into the judging thing. You know, I said to one of my sponsees the other day, I don't know if it's happening more or if I'm noticing it more. But lately, I have been seeing a lot of people judging, not hugging people, turning away from people, gossiping about people. It drives me crazy. I believe that for a lot of us, this is the last stop. We don't need to be doing this to each other. We need to be loving each other. We need to be hugging each other. We don't need to be tearing each other down and talking about each other and pushing each other away. I believe when we see each other acting out, that's when the person who's acting out needs us the most. You know, I truly believe that. And I know something else. Usually when God is putting something like that in front of my face a lot, it's because I need to look at something. Maybe that's why God's put it in front of my face. That I just feel like we need to wrap our arms around each other and love each other and not destroy each other. And I know that they say that the program is perfect and the fellowship is human, but I know that sometimes our behavior runs people out of the rooms. I know if people really have the desire to stay here, they'll stay here no matter what. I understand that. But sometimes I have seen people leave the rooms because of other people's behavior. And I think that's sad. I have a story and then I'm going to turn it over to my good friend Mike. I was really surprised. Mike and I have been friends for a long time, and I was pleasantly surprised when I was speaking with him today. It's a story, and this is about judging. You may have a person like this in your area. There's a little man, and it hurts my heart. There's a little man in our area, and I don't know if he's mentally retarded or if he's got a mental illness, but he calls himself Jesus. And he comes to meetings faithfully. He is at all our meetings all the time. And there are people who won't speak to him. They won't hug him. They talk about him like a dog, like he's not human. They say, oh, he touches the women. He takes money out of the basket. He bums cigarettes. Well, I know he asked me for a ride to a meeting one time, and he was in my car, and I saw his hand coming across the seat, and I turned to him and I said, you know what, Jesus? If you put your hand where it doesn't belong, I'm not going to give you a ride anymore. And he turned to me and he said, okay. And I thought, you know what? If people talked to him like he was a human being, instead of talking to him like he was an animal or ignoring him, maybe they wouldn't have a problem with him. Because that's all I had to say. And I never had another problem with that man. You know? And the other day, or it was a couple weeks ago, because I have some health problems, I had a backache, and I'm sitting in a meeting, because he hardly ever talks. And I was sitting in a meeting, and I was telling somebody, he was sitting in a chair behind me, and I was telling somebody that I had this backache, and he looks at me, and he says, I have one Aleve left, would you like to have it? And I thought, this guy who has no money, lives in a group home somewhere, is going to give me his last Aleve, you know? And I thought, you know, and then I saw somebody that I really respected. He went up to hug him, and they turned their back on him. And I thought, you know, this man probably goes to more meetings than you do. And I've heard people say, I don't even think he's an addict. I don't even know what he's doing here. You know, and I thought, how, you know, does any of us know what angels look like? Do you know, how can we, who's going to give us the next message? Do we know where we're going to get our help from? How do we have the right to turn our back on anybody? You know, I mean, that just, it just hurts me to my heart that we would do that to anybody, because, you know, we have people who come in these meetings, and we can probably think of 100 that when they first got here, they couldn't speak, they smelled funny, maybe they did take a dollar out of the basket, maybe they did chase the women when they shouldn't have, or women with the men, because we know that goes both ways. I'm not going to point my finger any direction, you know. And maybe after they got themselves together and they weren't so damn toxic, they were just fine. So who are we going to point our finger at, and who aren't we going to hug, and who aren't we going to speak to? Because you don't ever know where you're going to get your help from. So that's why I say we need to practice these principles in all our affairs, and we need to put them before the personalities, because you don't ever know. You just don't ever know. And thanks for letting me share, and I'll keep coming back.
Thanks for sharing. I'm Richard Nominati. At this time, I'd like to introduce our second speaker, Mike R.
I'm going to act on Mike. Hey. Hey, can you hear me in the back? Did they solve this? Is it all right? No? Can you hear me? You can't hear me? Can you hear me? No? Back there you can? All right. All right. I know you. I got your number. Thanks for sharing, Liz. I really got a lot out of what you had to say. You know, I used to chase the women when I first came around here. People talked about me. You know, I'm coming at you from, let me think. I got clean in Delaware in the Small Wonder area. And that's where I went to right after I got out of the treatment center, the psychiatric hospital. And I lived there for a right good while. I live in the east of the Bay Area on the Eastern Shore in Maryland. And oh, yeah, east of the Bay. Woo! Yeah. I love my area. Woo! I love east of the Bay. I'll tell you what, man, it's a great place to be. I'm out in the country, you know, it's the only time I ever see traffic is when y'all are coming through, going to the beach. And I've been down there, I guess, about over 10 years. And, you know, for some reason, I'm feeling extremely nervous. Usually, I don't get my heartbeat going like this. And, well, you know, usually I'm about 60 beats a minute, just kind of chilling out. Nothing bothers me. For some reason, I'm just like, whoa, like about 90 beats a minute, really kind of concerned. And I've done this before, so I don't know. I know I'm not scared of you, but I know you're just like me. You know, when I came to Narcotics Anonymous, and I looked around at the meetings, and the institution I went to, they told me that I was just like them, and that, you know, all I had to do was get a desire to stop using. And the only person that could get that desire for me was me, you know, and it wasn't anybody else in the meetings that could decide whether I belonged here or not. And, you know, and some of the most powerful things I've ever heard in Narcotics Anonymous meetings, I think, come directly out of the traditions, you know. Like the third tradition says the only requirement for membership is a desire to stop using. And like, you know, I came here and for a while, I never even really thought, you know, from time to time, do I want this? Do I want to stay clean? I was just coming because I knew my ass was on fire. And I didn't want to have any more consequences like was coming my way from my behavior. You know, I was caught up in the court system and doing an outpatient program thing and had to get the clean pee and I had the attendance slip and come into meetings and all that business. And, you know, I heard somebody say that they had a desire, you know, and that they wanted to be clean. You know, most of the other things that I'd been in before I came to Narcotics Anonymous were people that were committed and didn't want to. Like, I know this one group I was in, everybody was using. And And so, like, being here and finding, like, real addicts, I heard your stories. I know you're just like me. You know, but I'd look and I was still looking for the differences. You know, one of the things I really think about the principles before personalities is looking for the similarities. Me looking for me and you. And it's really easy for me to pick out what isn't like me and you, you know, and turn you off and not listen. And that's my disease. That comes with the disease of addiction, you know, that I'll be looking for differences and why don't I have to listen to you and the program that you live and that you're showing me how to live so I can get better, so I don't have to, you know, go back to using, be caught up in addiction, be sick, clean, front, thinking things are good. You know, I don't have to. You know, that I could work the Narcotics Anonymous program too. This isn't just a club where you can come and hang out, but a program as well. And you know, I was looking through the convention schedule, and you know what I know about this convention. I've been coming here. It's a great convention. I love it, you know, and always have a good time here. You know, the memories that I have of coming down here involve, like, you know, me and my friends, you know, going to meetings and you know, I was riding up here in 91 with my friends Sarah and Nick, and we rode up front of this, and it was old shitty before it got worked over convention center. The walls were concrete cinder blocks, and we had tiles, and we were riding up the front, and there was this little marquee about this big, and it said, "Welcome CPR 5, something like that. Welcome CPR. And my friend Nick was in the back. He goes, "What's CPR?" My friend Sarah says, "It's a life-saving course. Cardio respiratory resuscitation, you know." I said, "It's the name of the region's convention we're going to. It's just another party, you know." And, you know, they don't come to Narcotics Anonymous anymore. And, but when they were here and they worked the program and did service and had a sponsor, they were staying clean. And what I know is, you know, and I've tried to figure this whole thing out, because I really want to know what happens to the people that don't keep coming back. I've listened to people try to peer pressure people into sticking around here, calling them NA thieves if you don't do service kind of a thing and all that business. I don't know if you think that about people who, you know, got something good and left on out of here. You know, what I understand about the 12th step for Narcotics Anonymous, it says that having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, we tried to carry this message to addicts and to practice these principles in all our affairs. And I think that if you've really gotten everything that this program has to offer, you can't help but carry the message of Narcotics Anonymous. You can't help but tell other people how great your life is and what Narcotics Anonymous has done for you. And we really don't need to pressure you into doing some kind of service. At least that's my belief, that, you know, if you really have gotten everything. And I've seen people leave on out of here saying, "Well, I got everything. You know, I don't need to go to those meetings anymore." And the deal is that you didn't, because you wouldn't leave if you did. You know, because what's happened in my life? And, like, I looked at my life, and I was thinking about it earlier this week, about where I come from. And, you know, like I was saying, I didn't know addicts got clean. I didn't know that we got better lives. I didn't know that. And, like, I was a bum in my parents' house, and I wasn't going to ever do or get anything or be anything. And one day I was sick and tired of using, except there wasn't anything else to do, because I had to. And I know that I was home in my house, and I couldn't talk to anybody. I was completely isolated. I couldn't talk to my parents. Wasn't nobody to talk to. The people I was using with were using just like me. They didn't even know they had a problem. I went up to my room in my parents' house, and I covered my head with a pillow, and I cried because I knew I was going to die. I knew I wasn't. It's my birthday. I knew I wasn't going to live another year, and I didn't want to live another year. And I don't know if I cried, "God help me," because I would tell everybody on the street that there was no God. And you know, I got up the next morning, and I got high. Because I didn't know any other way. There wasn't anybody doing PI where I was at telling me, "Hey, man, you just don't have to get high again. Come to our meetings. We're staying clean." And, you know, I ended up screwing up a whole bunch of stuff in a very short amount of time. And like I was saying, I ended up in that psychiatric hospital. And then I attended NA meetings on the outside after that. There were like about 14 meetings where I got clean, 13 or 14. And, you know, it was awesome to be coming to meetings. You know, I was thinking about, like, I'd come to meetings and ask for cigarettes. I used to be able to smoke in meetings. You used to be able to smoke in meetings in this convention center. Half the room would be smoking, the other half would be not smoking. It'd be blowing across you trying to get away from the smoke. And so crazy stuff, you know. That I don't know the rationale behind that. But you know, and in being part of that Narcotics Anonymous, people really brought me in because I would be trying to hang out on the edges and I was trying to keep my back to the wall so no one could get behind me. And, you know, I had a lot of trust issues, and basically I came in just like I'd learned to live on the streets coming up in here. A lot of useless behaviors. Behaviors didn't help me in here, kept me away from people. I didn't get a sponsor right away because I had a probation officer, and I didn't know what a sponsor was, you know. I figured it was a duplication of efforts. And, you know, and I got a lot of fond memories of people. I got involved with hanging out with some people. I made a friend in Narcotics Anonymous. I didn't have a sponsor, and I'd go over and I'd eat dinner at his house. His mom would cook us some nice dinner, and I'd go to the activities committee because we were throwing dances and we wanted to have some fun. The guy told me we needed to go there, and I don't know why. I just went right along. I went right along with him, and we hung out, and I listened to these guys talk about throwing dances or parties and or tubing rides down the river, and they listened to me, you know, and blows my mind that they, like, listened to my great idea. We should go down the river, get all the addicts together and sell tickets for $7, and we'll go down the river. And we did that. It was my idea, you know. I mean, really, the people in Narcotics Anonymous brought me in. They made me matter, you know. And I really believe that it's important to me to listen to the newcomer. You know, if you want to talk to me about what's going on or you got an idea about service, I want to hear it, you know, because what I believe about God is that God speaks through people and that we get a group conscience by getting everybody's opinion and talking about what we want to do. And these people made me important. You know, I don't know about all that early recovery stuff or how important it is to the way I'm living today. You know, I know I've got just a limited amount of time and... you know, I know that, the other thing I was saying about CMP, we got a history of hiding the traditions meetings in workshops. And, like, I was looking at this, and I looked at the schedule, and I don't see any traditions meetings except for the fact that I know that they're there. You know what I mean? Like, and that was, like, the first year they did it, they mixed it up, and it was like you'd show up at a meeting to find out it was tradition. I think they'd tell the speakers, but nobody told me this is a traditions meeting. I just happened to realize that there isn't a 12th tradition meeting, which... You know, I looked at this, and I heard what Liz had to say. I thought, oh, man, I thought it was a 12th tradition meeting. But I know you talked about the spiritual principles. You know, anonymity is the spiritual foundation of all our traditions, ever reminding us to place principles before personalities. And, you know, what I was thinking about that is that ain't easy, you know, because if it was easy to practice anonymity for us, we wouldn't need to be reminded to practice, place principles before personalities. It's not an easy thing to do, which is why they tell us twice with the same tradition to practice anonymity, you know. And I was just at an 11th tradition meeting a couple weeks ago, and I was thinking about, there it talks about anonymity in that tradition too, and what I know is that when you go breaking your personal anonymity at the level of press, radio, and films, I think level of press, radio, and films could be internet. It could be, you know what I mean? Like, there's things that are levels of press, radio, and films. Don't be violating your personal anonymity. You know why? It's the newcomer who ain't going to come up in here because you'd be doing that. It's the newcomer who might not come back. It's the people who aren't here who are going to see you and say, oh, shit, I don't want to divulge that I'm an addict. You know, I don't want to have to do that. And then it's the public who, for the people who do that and relapse, and then public go, oh, well, NA doesn't work anyway. You know, it's somebody's mom says, well, I don't need to send my addict to my husband or my kid to NA because we know that doesn't work. And you know what? I know by coming here that Narcotics Anonymous works. I know just by looking at you that Narcotics Anonymous works. You know, so I don't want that happening. You know, I don't know. I'm still feeling kind of scattered, and I don't know what that's all about. But, you know, as far as, you know, being here in Narcotics Anonymous, I know I keep coming back here because I don't believe I can stay clean on my own. You know, I've met people who I think get it together or whatever, think they can stay clean on their own, and that ain't me, you know. And, you know, summing up my life, I've been looking around. I'm married, and I have got a house, and I've got a job. And this is all stuff that I was never, ever, ever going to have on the path that I was before I came to Narcotics Anonymous. I got 3 children. I met my wife here, and she is crazy. I related to her. No, I mean, you know, to meet someone that I identify with so well that I could have a friend like my wife, to make a commitment to marry her and be with her, to be a partnership and having a house and raising children, it's just an amazing gift, you know. And we got these 12 steps and 12 traditions to try and live in our lives so that we can have relationships, and it still isn't easy. I grew up in a place where nobody communicated. And so, you know, sometimes we'll be trying to work out a problem, and I find that I can't communicate. And that's with clean time and working the program and know what the issues are, and I just we need to talk about this later. And I don't know why we can't. I'll be willing to talk to you about it later. I don't know why. Sometimes it's that way. And like, I really believe that the Narcotics Anonymous program is a process. You know, it's not a destination. They didn't get done all 12 steps and say, all righty, time to kick back and enjoy my nice, warm Narcotics Anonymous seat, you know. And you know, what I know about the steps and traditions, the 12 steps are what's going to help me change, is going to help me be the addict, give me the life that I'll be able to stay clean for, and give me a way of life that I can live that life. And that the 12 traditions are what makes it so I'm not killing other people in Narcotics Anonymous, makes it so that we can all be here together. And, you know, maybe I didn't say that so easy, but the 12 steps will keep me from committing suicide, and the 12 traditions will keep me from committing homicide. And so, you know, in my crazy life, you know, like, I've been looking at it lately, and, you know, I think some people, they get their lives together and they realize they need to go back to school, kind of a thing. And both me and my wife realized it at the same time. And, like, I've been working this full-time job and go to work real early, come home, and, you know, go to school during the day. And then I come home, my wife leaves out and goes to school, and it's like hi and bye. And, you know, I've been thinking about, it blows me away that, like, I'm in school. I'm going back to college to try to get my bachelor's degree. And I don't know why I never got it before, and maybe it's all about fear and thinking that I, you know, wasn't good enough. There were some events in my life came up, and I said, man, I can't do this right now. I got to do this other thing. You know, my first daughter was born, and I had to have a job or whatever, but I never got back to school. And, you know, I've been going down to, I enrolled in school, which is like a huge deal for me. And I'm in class, and I'm looking around, and I'm twice as old as everybody there. And that was like a barrier to me even going down to register, you know, saying, well, it's been so long since I've been in school that I'm not going to be able to remember the stuff that I was supposed to remember to even start doing this work. And I got a C on my first test. And you know what? I really want an A. But I know maybe you can identify with this. I want the A without doing any work. And it's because I deserve it. Because I need, you know, I got probably 10 or 11 classes to get this degree that we're talking about. And, you know, I can fit one class in my life. Might take 5 years, but when I'm not taking any classes, I wasn't getting any closer to getting it. And, you know, what's so different for me this time is that I've gone to every class. And I try to participate in class. And after I got that C, and I was saying, shit, I want an A. Fuck the C. You know, I mean, like, I could take this C or whatever, but, you know, my work will pay for me to get a C, but that's just not, you know, I want to take the next class, and the C might not be good enough to build on what I want. And so I started studying. That's right. And I got 105 on the second exam. And blew my mind. Yeah, the last class I was in, like, everyone's, like, afraid to say something. The teacher's right on the board. He goes, anyone, anyone? I'm just like, you know, yeah. People are looking at me and all this. You know what? I don't think I want to tell them how I'm doing in class anymore because I feel like I'm getting judged. But you know what? I mean, the old guy's doing good. But... you know, I know that, you know, one of the things that happened, there's some changes in my life. Me and my wife and two of my children got in a severe car accident about 2 years ago. And so we needed to make some changes to live the life that we were having. My wife had a full spine fusion. She got a block in her back and titanium and all that back there. And I had a major back surgery. And so we had to change some things to live and... you know, before that, we were both involved, heavily involved in Narcotics Anonymous service. And, you know, both were officers at area trying to carry the message or going to regional service or whatever. And, you know, to me, I like to do service because I can. As long as I can do service, I want to be of service in Narcotics Anonymous. As long as I'm on this side, I want to do something. I want to reach out. I'm the most alive when I'm helping addicts. I know it. And I feel like it's a gift. Each of us is given the gift of, you know, once you got some recovery, you got something to give somebody else. And when you take the time to share that with them, the whole fellowship is built on goodwill. Everybody that I've helped, you know, I don't know how much they help me in return beyond what I can imagine. You know, so many people that I've helped have helped me in return. And, you know, so there have been times when, like, I see people on tragedy comes into their life or changes happen. They say, oh, man, life is going on, and I got to back away. I got to take some time for me, man. Things are going on at home. And so they stop up, and they drop off the box or the bag, and they're gone. And I'll, you know what, I mean, I've cared about people in Narcotics Anonymous and they've used and they've gone and I said, oh, shit, I'm never going to care about another person again. You know, I helped him and he stayed clean and now he's gone and I'm not going to do it again. And I got over, you know what I mean, like what happened was I actually learned what the first step says. Because it says, we admitted we were powerless over our addiction that our lives have become unmanageable. And I'm not in charge of what goes on. It ain't nothing personal when somebody goes and uses, not against me. It's the disease, you know, and I've learned to not take it personally. You know, what I know is the best place I can share about my recovery in Narcotics Anonymous is at a Narcotics Anonymous meeting. People looking for recovery are up in an NA meeting, you know, and, you know, if I'm sitting in a meeting and I don't hear people sharing about recovery, then it's up to me to share about recovery. You know, if what's going on in the meeting isn't right, if it's not Narcotics Anonymous recovery, it's like my duty to say something. You know, you know, the thing that has stopped me, it's called the attitude of indifference or intolerance, you know. It says in How It Works that that shit's built in. That's the default, you know. You got to actively work a program to overcome that. And, you know, so what's happened here is that we were talking about what was going on up at Area Service, and I ain't been there for a little while. And my wife woke up and she said, I had a dream that you went to area and you volunteered to be the special events chair. And I was like, that's a crazy dream. But then, and I was going to go up there, but then something happened. I couldn't make it up there for the elections. And then, you know what position didn't get filled up at area service? It was a special events chairperson position. So I went up there the next month and nobody wanted it. Yeah, I took it. Yeah. You know it. But you know, the first service position I ever took was so you guys would know that I was here. I was like, hey, look at me. I'm going to do a service position in NA. And after that, the one that I wanted was the one that nobody else wanted. And that one has jumped around. It's been a lot of different positions as far as doing some service up in NA. And I feel, you know what I mean, Liz was talking about her home group up in Baltimore. You know what, my home group's not the best home group in Narcotics Anonymous. It ain't. It's okay home group. But it's my home group. You know, and I'd like to help make it the best home group. I've been to some really good meetings and said, man, I really like what you guys got going on here, you know. And it's given me things that I would like to have my home group strive to be, you know. And I guess the reality is that not everybody can have the best home group in Narcotics. I like the people who think that theirs is. And you know what? Mine was the best home group in Narcotics Anonymous from about 1988 to about 1993. It was the best NA meeting in the world. And I haven't had one like that. I mean, like, I really like the groups, you know, that I've been involved in, but ain't the best, you know. We want to be the best. You know, I'm real grateful to be a Narcotics Anonymous member, clean. You know, there have been times I've looked at my life and thought, well, how the hell is it that I've been staying clean, you know? And I know that I really believe that everybody who ends up in Narcotics Anonymous is chosen by God to get here. You know, and then once you're here and you find out that addicts are staying clean against all odds, against all adversity, living their lives no matter what it is, it's up to you to choose it. You know, I listened to Steve gave a percentage in our meeting earlier about what percentage of people actually stick around here after they get here. And I ain't been counting everybody, but a lot of people don't stay, you know. A lot of people don't want this brand of getting better. A lot of people want to just go get high. Coming up in NA, not ready, you know. And, well, you know, one of the nice things I like is about the program, the steps written in order. If you work the first step and you make that admission, you work the second step and you start being open-minded, a power greater than yourself, greater than ourselves, restoring you to sanity. If you get to the third step and find that you're not ready to make that decision, work on the first two steps. No big deal. Work on the, you know what I mean? Like, work the steps that you can. And if you get to a point where you can't, share with people, share with your sponsor. That's what I did, you know. My process has taken me the time that it's taken. And in a lot of ways, you know, I'm in a position where I get to use the principles that I have in my life to help me live the life I got now. You know, I used to really like this one guy who used to say, you know, you're right where you're supposed to be for the work that you've done. And I really feel like, you know what, I used to hear like, well, Narcotics Anonymous is not a race. And it ain't, man. You don't have to be in a hurry to work the program. But in a lot of ways, it is a race. You got to stay at least far enough into the steps in front of your disease so it doesn't get you and take your recovery away. And I really feel like I've sponsored people who, you know, were unwilling to work the next step, weren't trying to be open-minded, weren't being willing. You know, and they could tell you, I'm just not willing, you know. I'll do it in God's time, not mine. And what that meant was, I ain't doing it in my time. My time, I ain't doing it. You know what I mean? And you know, it's a, you know, I can see when I ain't being honest. I know when I'm not being honest. It took some time in early recovery where I just tell the lie because I know about telling some lies, telling some wonderful shit. And I can tell when I know when I'm not willing, you know, and I'll just sit and I won't. I have a hard time knowing when I'm not open-minded, you know, because you'd be thinking you're open-minded and you're not, and you'll never see it. I would never see it. But, you know, I'm really just, I'm so grateful to be in Narcotics Anonymous, and thank you for letting me share.
Thank you, Mike. We got about 5 or 10 minutes of additional time. If anyone would like to share, remember to share briefly and come up to the podium to share.
Motion to close. All right.
I'm Richard Nominati. Let's close with a moment of silence.